Welcome to JBJS Ortho Corps. Listen as members of the ortho community, residents, surgeons, educators, staff, and patients share their stories about the experiences and people most important in their lives and the lessons they learned along the way. Ortho Corps is an audio archive inspired by StoryCorps and independently organized by the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Dr. Stuart Weinstein is one of the most influential orthopedic surgeons of our time, having led multiple societies and multiple initiatives which have shaped modern orthopedics. He's been a role model for many, including myself. He has the perspective of treating pediatric and adult scoliosis patients, including early onset scoliosis. He has a knack for asking and answering the big questions and putting together teams to lead research to answer them. He's agreed to talk to us today through JBJS Ortho Corps about his perspectives on the evolution of idiopathic scoliosis treatment. Stuart is the Ignacio Ponseti Professor of Orthopedics at the University of Iowa. After completing medical school and residency in Iowa City, he has practiced there for his entire 46-year career. His leadership contributions include having been president of the AAOS, ABOS, AOA, and on the board of directors of JBJS, and many other contributions. He's also led the U.S. section of the Bone and Joint Decade Initiative, which was to increase funding and awareness for musculoskeletal research. He's also led efforts on medical liability reform and led the AOS PAC. He's published over 250 peer-reviewed papers, given twice as many invited talks, and mentored numerous orthopedic surgeons who are leaders in their own fields. Some of the papers which are most relevant to this discussion include the 40-year and the landmark 50-year follow-up of the Natural History of Untreated AIS, the BRACED study, and many others. He published one of the first papers on growing rods, which was then called Mohr rod surgery, showing that it had some problems and it's moved on since then. In short, he is responsible for our understanding that scoliosis does progress after adulthood if it's severe, about a degree per year, that idiopathic scoliosis, unlike syndromic and neuromuscular scoliosis, does not greatly affect life expectancy, and that bracing does work in a dose-dependent fashion. One of his current big projects is the CAS versus brace trial, a society-funded prospective study of brace versus cast for EOS. Dr. Weinstein, thank you for taking some of your time to expand on the topic of AIS. Can you tell us what were the influences in your early years which formed your academic orientation?
Well, I think I was extremely fortunate to train at the University of Iowa, where all the faculty members were full-time. They were not motivated by financial incentives. They were all doing either basic science or clinical research and all trying to improve patient care. These included Carol Larson, Reg Cooper, Adrian Flatt, Mike Bonfilio, and my particular mentor, Ignacio Ponseti. So when they asked me to join the faculty in 1976, it was like coming to play with your heroes. And I was just extremely honored to be invited. But they were my early role models. And I also want to give a shout out to someone who I didn't train with, and that's Dr. John Hall, because like most in my generation, we're kind of self-trained. I didn't do a fellowship, but after I finished my residency, my chairman sent me to spend a month with Dr. Hall, and I was obviously one of many visitors, but I saw in Dr. Hall an extremely critical thinker about spinal deformity issues and a very gracious individual who during my life and his practice time, he was always willing to look at a case, which in those days meant reprinting x-rays and sending a handwritten note. But he was always generous with his time and thoughts. So he's another role model that I met in the early to mid-60s who stimulated my career.
Yes, he was a role model for me too. What caused you to choose pediatric orthopedics?
Well, when I was near the end of my residency, one of my co-residents, a little ahead of me, was Dennis Wenger, and we were both really interested in children's because it covered the entire musculoskeletal system. We talked about practicing together, which obviously never happened, but we both really interested in taking care of children. And when the chairman at the time offered me the chance to help Dr. Ponsetti, it was like, wow, how could I refuse this opportunity? And the other area or other area of interest is that when I finished my residency, this was the early part of the instrumentation of scoliosis with Harrington Rods. It was just becoming widespread around the world. And there was no one in Iowa, population of 3 million, taking care of spinal deformity patients. So this was an opportunity that I, a void that I felt that I needed to fill.
How did you become so interested in the natural history of scoliosis and other things? And how did you accomplish these bringbacks? And how do you interpret their significance now?
Sure. Well, I think part of my education, and which I still think is part of the education of our residents at Iowa, is you need to understand the natural history of every condition you're treating to decide, you know, is the outcome bad or if it's okay. And then the second part of that is if you're going to apply treatments, you have to see, do they actually make the natural history better without introducing other complications? So when I finished my residency at the time, you know, SRS was only 10 years in existence, and especially societies in general weren't as strong as they are today. And probably 95% of education came through the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And I attended a STAR course, which brought together all the world authorities on scoliosis. And one of the speakers, who was a thought leader of the early 70s, was giving the natural history talk. And he talked about the papers by Alf Nakenson and Nilsson and Lundgren, which were published in Acta Scandinavia in 1968. And these two papers presented an extremely grim prognosis for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, and basically said you're going to be have back pain, you're going to have cardiopulmonary compromise, you'll have a shortened life, you won't marry, you won't be able to have children, etc. And then one of the questioners in the audience asked, well, what about this Iowa group that had been reported in 1948 and in the 60s of untreated patients? And the speaker basically said, you know, this is not how it is. And those patients actually come to my center for treatment. So I was pretty depressed. I went home from that course. And again, being drummed into my brain that we need to know the natural history, I thought, well, if the Iowa studies that I had been familiar with and had actually seen some of the patients were faulty, I need to bring that to the front. So I spent 2 years. Unfortunately, Dr. Steinler was an amazing record keeper, kept everything, was very well organized, had type notes since the 1920s, and had kept all of the x-rays. So I spent a year and a half just combing through his files, organizing a list of about 300 untreated adolescent idiopathic scoliosis patients. So the first thing I did was send that list to the person who had given the talk, saying they all come to his center for treatment. And in fact, only one patient had come to that center for treatment, and that was for a disc herniation. So I put that aside. Then I looked at the Nilsson, Lundgren, and Alf Nakenson papers and realized that these are retrospective reviews. Many of the patients were lost, small numbers. But most important, they were mixed etiology, including many early onset cases. It was questionable whether the patients were actually seen and examined. And then in those days, you could question any study on questionnaire validity. So I spent the next 2 years from 1976 to 1978 tracing all of the Iowa patients and asked them if they could come back to Iowa City for an evaluation. Fortunately, this cadre of patients, which weren't all from Iowa, some were from Minnesota, some Illinois, Missouri, surrounding states, and even Chicago, were intensely loyal to Dr. Steindler, who was their treating physician. And they came back, and I had the good fortune of seeing these patients. And they were severely affected in the sense that the average thoracic curve was about 85 degrees, the average thoracolumbar curve 90, the double majors were 80 over 80. And I personally examined each and every one of these patients. I went over their questionnaires with them. And then I made a bargain with them. Would they please keep in contact with me, or could I keep in contact with them every 10 years? And that led to the continuous follow-up of these patients over 50 years. And surprisingly, I could never get a resident to do any of these projects with me, so I actually did them myself. But that really enhanced my knowledge base, and I think made me a better purveyor of knowledge to my patients. But long story short, the loyalty of these patients and their willingness to participate, I'm extremely grateful for. In the early days, this was self-funded by the department, and you could easily ask the radiologist to waive the fee for the x-ray, so that was not a big deal. Not possible today, of course. And then for the last study, I was able to get funding through the ORF, Children's Miracle Network. And also one of the untreated patients was quite well-to-do, and she had a 90-degree thoracolumbar curve, and she used her family foundation money to help me to do the 50-year follow-up. So for me, I learned a great deal. I mean, you can certainly criticize these studies. First one published in JBGS in 81, and then the progression data was published in 83, and the final follow-up in 2003 was published in JAMA. But it's really hard to find another natural history group followed this long. And for me, it just makes me, again, as I said, a better purveyor of a discussion, an informed discussion with my patients about what the outcomes are and how to decide treatment.
That's great information. After your landmark JAMA 50-year follow-up, which seemed to show AIS in a relatively benign light, I would have expected the incidence of people seeking surgery to decline. Instead, it's almost skyrocketed. Do you see it the same way? And how do you explain this trend? How do the study results influence your discussion with patients and your indications?
Sure. Well, I think I could use my own patient population, since I did 95% of all the scoliosis in Iowa for at least 42 years, that my numbers of AIS cases were basically the same. I think you're seeing increased numbers because, number one, there's better awareness. I think there's better detection by primary care physicians. And another factor is there's more physicians treating patients with scoliosis. And I think the question about, are the indications for everyone the same? So the numbers may be increasing, but we still know that adolescent idiopathic scoliosis only affects 2 to 3% of the population, and 97% of those don't need any treatment at all. It's only that 2 to 3% that ever come to treatment. So I think it's a factor of better, earlier detection, more patients coming to the doctor earlier, advances in treatment, increased number of surgeons actually providing treatment. And I think when you look at surgical series, you look at surgery series in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the curve magnitudes were much higher, whereas now I think the average curve size is much lower in most series. So I guess more aggressive approach to active treatment.
So school screening seems to have fallen out of fashion in most communities after perhaps having been initiated when we thought scoliosis was a worse problem. Where do you think the sweet spot is with scoliosis early detection and screening?
Yeah, I think the group from it's Olmsted County, where the Mayo Clinic is located, showed that school screening was not cost effective. And as I think many of our listeners will know, that the U.S. Preventive Task Force recommended against screening because they felt there was no effective treatment. This was in 2004. Now that we know there is effective treatment, I'm not sure that school screening is effective, but what I think of the sweet spot is that every single primary care physician should be doing an Adams forward bend test on every single well child visit, sports physical, so that early detection through that mechanism, as opposed to formalized school screening programs, would be the ideal way to detect scoliosis early and get patients appropriately referred.
That's a nice nugget right there. What was the impetus for the BRACED study, and what were the challenges in carrying it out, and what do you think its impact has been so far?
Well, the impetus for the BRACED study is that since my career start, I could really never figure out how braces actually work. How does this change a skeletal deformity. I could always understand how braces on your teeth or an external fixator, things that are directly attached to the skeleton, could modify growth. But I couldn't figure out how this external device works. So first, we followed our Milwaukee brace patients and showed that, and again, in the early days, we were using the Milwaukee brace on everybody, curves over 40 degrees, even over 50 degrees. And what we showed with our follow-up, which is published in JBJS in the 90s, was that once the brace ceased, the curves followed their own natural history, and many of the larger curves went on to surgery. In the 80s, most of us switched to thoracolumbar sacral orthoses, underarm braces, and we reviewed our underarm braces, and we found that 60% of those failed. So the next question for me was, well, am I and my team of orthotists doing a terrible job? Is it just us or is it everybody? So we did a systematic review of bracing around the country. And most of the studies in the literature, of which there were many, were level 3 and 4 evidence. And it was clear that the failure rates range from 0, which I don't believe, to 76% failure rates. So it was, that was the next step. Then the next step was asking members of the SRS in POSNA. We gave them 12 scenarios of curves less than 35, over 35, skeletally immature, skeletally mature. And what do they feel the risk reduction from using a brace would be? And we got numbers all over the map from 0 to 76%. So it was pretty clear to me that those of us who were the so-called experts had no clue whether braces work or they don't work. And around the time we decided to embark upon the brace study, it was clear there were two camps: zealots who felt you need to wear a brace 23 hours a day, and others like me who weren't really sure, maybe we should just follow patients until they reached their surgical threshold. So we did a lot of preliminary studies. We were able to get a planning grant from the NIH. And then eventually we realized, and the NIH was good enough to support this project, as was the Canadian equivalent of the NIH and the Shriners Hospitals, to do this randomized prospective trial on bracing versus observation. The funding for this came from those three sources. The challenges are that surgeons are surgeons and they like to do surgical studies. They're not really as interested in studies that really don't involve surgery or new technology, et cetera. So those are the challenges. But I think those of us in the pediatric spinal deformity world and the pediatric world in general are very fortunate, because I think we have a dedicated group of people who really do care about answering questions. So we were able to get centers across North America, United States, and Canada to do the brace study. One problem that we did encounter is it was a randomized prospective trial, and after 2 years, we were lagging a bit in our enrollment, so we had to add a preference arm. But nevertheless, the brace study did show level one evidence that braces do work to prevent the need for surgery. And I want to emphasize one thing is, I think parents' concern is not a 5 degree or 10 degree progression of their child's curve. Their main concern is they don't want their child to have surgery. Can you prevent them from having surgery? And to me, that's kind of the main indicator, you know, or the main outcome of brace, preventing the need for surgery. So how has this helped me in my practice? Well, I think studying natural history and studying, knowing that braces are effective, it's helped me, again, be a better purveyor of information, because I view my job for the patient and their families to be their navigator, to help them decide, you know, what's best treatment for them. They're the boss, and I'm just helping them, providing the best information that's available in 2023. And so the brace has profoundly affected me, but has opened many, 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 many more questions about the non-operative treatment of scoliosis.
Thanks. Yeah, I think patients and parents can tell if you're sincere about what you're trying to tell them. And this allowed me, and I'm sure others, to be really convinced that bracing is the right answer and convince them in a more effective way to go for it. I know you've been fortunate to work with the talented Dr. Lori Dolan for many years. How did this collaboration come about? And do you have any advice for early career surgeons seeking to find similar clinical research partners?
Sure. Well, the first part of my career from 76 to 92 was basically done by myself and occasionally with residents on and fellows on projects. But in 1992, when I was going to do the 50-year follow-up of AIS patients, I was fortunate enough to be able to get an OREF grant, which allowed me to hire a research assistant. And through the network of collaborators at Iowa, I was able to meet Lori, who was a nurse by her original training, but was had a master's degree in statistics and was going to work on a PhD. And so that's how we came to work together. And then Lori obviously became extremely interested in scoliosis and did her PhD there. And we, since 1992, have collaborated on every single research project. And she, I would say, has made everything I've done better. I'm not sure I've made everything she's done better, but fortunately, her office is only a few steps away from mine. And every day when I come from the clinic or come from the OR, I stop by and give her about 10 new ideas. And then she puts things in perspective and says, you know, we really can't do that. We don't have the resources. But I think if I write a paper, she then makes it better. And I hope that when she's the primary author, I hope that I help her make things better. But we've been collaborators now for 32 years, and it's been one of the great joys of my life. So how do you find a Lori Dolan? I think you have to, when you're starting your career, if you're going to get a research assistant, you have to find someone who has the same passion you do about answering questions. You don't want a technician or a statistician. You want someone who really is interested in the conditions you're studying and has the same passion for answering the questions that you do.
That's a good point. Where do you see the field of scoliosis treatment going, especially in borderline topics like growth-friendly surgeries, proactive versus reactive approach to moderate AIS, and non-fusion options?
Well, I think there's a lot of work to be done. So I'll say that the first thing is, I think, just carry on with the non-operative treatment. I think we need to develop better braces. We need to develop braces that children would not mind wearing as much, that might allow them to participate in activities. So we need a lot of work in the bracing area. We also need to know specifically how do braces work. We think that they unload the concave side of the growth plates, but you know, I'm not sure exactly how they do work. And I think we need to answer those questions. I think, you know, growth modulation is very popular, and all the technology changes, like vertebral body tethering, ApiFix devices, et cetera, 3D, robotics, navigation. I mean, these catch the eye of younger surgeons. I must admit, I look at them a little bit differently. I'm a freehander for everything, and I haven't found these to be helpful to me. But I would say that young surgeons really look to these new technologies exciting, and maybe they will improve outcomes. So I think when it comes to technology, my personal feeling is that all patients engaged or involved in new technology need to be involved in clinical trials. The data needs to be captured. We need to know, are these really worth the cost? Are the outcomes better than standard treatments? You know, for example, vertebral body tethering was approved by the FDA, I think, on the basis of 54 cases. And I think young surgeons want to get on the bandwagon with new technology, be able to offer everything. But I think we need to investigate these. Patients need to be aware that this is new technology. It's being investigated and need to participate in clinical trials. So I think those things, the new technology needs to be studied enough to know, is it worth the additional costs? Are the outcomes better? Are patients made safer by these techniques? Are their long-term outcomes better? So those are things that I think need to be answered. I think, again, surgeons are surgeons. The incentive is to do surgery. We like to do surgery. I like to do it. But I think when we do all these new technologies, they should be studied appropriately, either through study groups or through grants and centers. So and the one area that's not really getting much emphasis, which is really important, is genetics, because you can have two patients with the identical curves, same age, same sex, but their genetics are different, how they respond to a brace, their body properties, how they even respond to surgery are very different. So we need to know a lot more about adolescent idiopathic scoliosis in the genetic area. And I think that'll really help us make solid treatment decisions in the next 30 to 50 years.
I agree. Just big picture, do you think there are any aspects that we are wrongly emphasizing as leaders of the profession? The SRS likes to have funding priorities. What do you think are the most pressing areas for AIS which we need to focus on to solve now, perhaps besides genetics?
Yeah, I think that there's a little too much emphasis on technology. I'm all for advancement of technology, but I think it needs the groups like the SRS should be organizing formal studies on these so that the same data, the same entrance criteria into the study is done, and that data is captured and then reviewed independently to see, are we making a difference? I think that's, when it comes to technology, which is the, you know, the buzzword today, I mean, everyone is into technology of some sort. It needs to be studied carefully. And I think that's where resources should be placed, as well as non-operative treatment and genetic research.
If I can ask you, which of your many research projects are you most proud of and why?
Well, that's a tough question. Well, first of all, I'm really proud of these studies, only because they give clinicians some information which they can use to make hopefully better decisions going forward. But I'm also, you know, proud of another line of research. I started, like most pediatric orthopedic surgeons, as a general pediatric orthopedic surgeon, though 95% of my practice is deformity. And one line of research which I'm particularly proud of is our long-term follow-ups of children's hip conditions. Slip capitofemoral epiphysis, Perthes disease. We also did Shorman's kyphosis, spondylolisthesis. Those things have been, again, made me a better purveyor of discussions with patients on informed decision making. But our DDH line of treatment, I think, again, emphasizing my Iowa roots, you know, Dr. Steindler, who trained in Austria, treated a lot of DDH, hundreds of DDH patients treated by closed reduction. And to his credit, he followed those and looked at outcomes. And when the follow-ups weren't good, he made alterations. If they were good, he kept using the same protocol. When Dr. Ponsetti took over, he followed Steindler's patients. And as long as they were doing well, he didn't change the protocol. And the only thing he added to the treatment of DDH was using adductor tenotomies to increase the ability to do a close reduction. And he followed his patients. And then I followed his and Steindler's patients and was able to, you know, follow 152 closed reductions for over 40 years. And then in the 1970s, I started doing open reductions because I felt that the results weren't very as good with closed, and continued to follow those patients and discuss learn the obstacles reduction, define a new approach to the anteromedial approach to these reductions. And I continue to have a passion for hip dysplasia. We'll have a paper coming out in JBS soon about acetabular dysplasia and DDH as opposed to the hot topic of adolescent dysplasia, which is certainly changing the world with the advent of new hip preservation surgery. So I'm really proud of all of our long-term follow-ups, and also the fact that, you know, we try to answer fundamental questions about all the pediatric orthopedic conditions to just give a bigger information base to help practitioners practice evidence-based practice and help their patients make intelligent decisions.
Reminds me that Dr. John Hall used to say there are dozens of people he would trust to treat his child's spine, but only a handful he would trust to treat his child's hip. So I think that is indeed true, that judgment plays a big role there. And Stuart, I know we've caught you on vacation. Can you tell us a little bit about what you like to do when you're not working on orthopedics?
Well, I'm an exercise fanatic. I'm a run every day, and in in the Iowa spring, summer, and fall, I ride bike every weekend, and I also love to climb mountains. So I'm in Colorado for my 2-week body cleansing, mental cleansing by climbing mountains in Colorado.
Great. In closing, how would you mentor young orthopedic surgeons to set them up for success in delivering contributions over an entire career like you've done?
I think the important thing is to always find excitement every single day you go to work. There's not a day that I go to work that I don't come back or write down a question that doesn't make sense to me, or why this patient's behavior of their condition is different than somebody else's. So I find that when you have a passion for what you do, it's not work, it's a joy. And I think when you start your career, you want to put yourself in a place that has a nurturing environment that can help you be successful. You need a faculty to help be successful. It's ideal if you have a senior mentor, or it doesn't have to be in your institution, it could be someplace else, someone you can rely on to discuss controversial issues. And you need to set yourself up for success. And many people would not have the situation I had with this treasure trove of patients over a century, but participating in study groups or shared collaborations between colleagues who have the same interest as yours, you can get a lot done and have a very exciting life. So it's getting yourself in the right environment, finding joy and excitement every single day in practice, and surrounding yourself with people, not necessarily in your institution, but that you find that you have the same passions that will lead to a very successful career.
Great, I love it. So thank you for all those pieces of wisdom. I guess to summarize, I think that every teenager should have a clinical screening for spine deformity, and that we should study our technology and our new innovations formally as we go prospectively, and that we should try to find the interesting parts of our career and the patient challenges that come to us in our daily practice. So Dr. Weinstein, it's been very inspirational to talk to you, and I've always found your work to be incredibly informative, and it shaped how I approach my practice. And so thank you for taking this time to talk to us through JBJS OrthoCore, and enjoy the rest
of
the
day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.